Good morning. This is Samantha Barnes returning with the Herald and Review. We will now continue with the death notices on page A1. Indicator, Lena Jo Jody Carter, 74, of Decatur, died at 12:30 p.m. Saturday, November 28, 2015, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral service celebrating her life will be at 5 p.m. Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, at Christian Church of Decatur, 3350 North MacArthur Road. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. Tuesday at the church. Burial will be at 1:30 p.m. Wednesday, December 2nd, 2015, in Hudsonville City Cemetery, Hudsonville, Missouri. Memorials may be made out to DMH Hospice or the Alzheimer's Association. Tyson Logan Funeral Services and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Please sign the family guest book at www.tlccelebratingeverylife.com. Wilma R. Crute, 84, of Mokena, passed away Friday, November 27, 2015, in her home, along with her faithful companion and best buddy. Services to celebrate Wilma's life will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, at Morin and Goble Funeral Home. Visitation will be for one hour prior to the services at the funeral home. Burial will be Wednesday at 11 a.m. December 2nd, 2015, at Bone Gap Cemetery in Bone Gap, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to the Mokena Fire Department or Ambulance Service. Joseph Neil Gorski, 89, of Warrensburg, Illinois, formerly of Lathen, Illinois, passed away Tuesday, November 24, 2015, at McKinley Court Care Center, Decatur. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, December 1st at Brittlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, Illinois, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service. Private family interment will be at Warrensburg Illini Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Lathen Methodist Church or Central Christian Church, Decatur, Illinois. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Brittlinger and Earl Funeral Home at www.brittlingerandearl.com. Charles Daniel Danny Metcalf, 70, of Macon, died November 23, 2015, in his home. Memorial graveside service will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, December 2, 2015, in Macon Cemetery, Macon, Illinois, with full military honors by Mokena American Legion Post 370. Seats Funeral Home in Mokena has been entrusted with the care and service arrangements. Condolences for the family may be left at www.seatsfh.com. 95-year-old Marcella E. Starver of Herrick died Friday, November 27th at 2:10 a.m. at Prairie Rose Health Care Center, Pana, Illinois. Funeral services will be Wednesday, December 2nd at 11 a.m. at Hendrick Christian Church in Herrick, Illinois, with Paul Dickerson officiating. Visitations will be from 9 a.m. Wednesday, December 2nd, at Herrick Christian Church, Herrick, Illinois. Burial will be at An Oak Cemetery, Bowling Green, Torp, Fayette County, in Illinois. Condolences can be made at kennedypana.com. Paul Leader Hayduck Jr., 83, of Huntington, Tennessee, passed away November 9, 2015, in Jackson Madison County Hospital in Jackson, Tennessee. His memorial services will be held November 12th at Huntington First Methodist Church. Eleanor Hoffman, 86, of Clinton, in Illinois, passed away at 9:30 p.m. November 26, 2015, at Manor Court in Clinton. Services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, December 12th, at Cavart Funeral Home, Clinton, Illinois, with Donovan Garner officiating. Burial will follow at Texas Township Cemetery in Clinton, Illinois. Visitation will be 2 hours prior to the service at Cavart Funeral Home in Clinton. Memorials may be made out to the Clinton YMCA or the Weldon Springs Foundation. Mary Catherine Lachandrisi passed away in the Redlands, California, on November 12, 2015. Mass will be held on December 4th at St. Patrick's Church at 1 p.m. Interment will be at St. Isidore Cemetery in Bethany, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Marie Claire Leonard, 76, of Niantic, passed away Monday, November 23rd, 2015, in St. Mary's Mayo Clinic Hospital, Rochester, Minnesota, of renal cancer. Visitations will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, November 29th, at Bricklinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Funeral Mass will be from 10 a.m. Monday at Resurrection Catholic Church in Annapolis, Illinois. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Annapolis. Condolences may be left for the family in care of the Bricklinger and Earl Funeral Home at www.bricklingerandearl.com. Robert Glenn Bob Matherly, 76, of Decatur, died at 9:30 p.m. Saturday, November 21st, 2015, at St. Mary's Hospital. Graveside services celebrating Bob's life will be at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, December 1st, in the Veterans Section in Graceland Cemetery, and military rites will be conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard. There will be no visitation, and memorials may be given to the Alzheimer's Association. Tithes and Logan Funeral Services and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Please sign the family guest book at www.tlc.com. CelebratingEveryLife.com. Esther M. Noren, 53, of Lakewood, Illinois, passed away November 25, 2015, at her home. Memorial services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, December 2, 2015, at United Methodist Church in Cowden, Illinois. Visitations will be Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelby, Illinois. Online condolences may be made at www.lockhartgreenfuneralhomes.com. Mark N. Norwood, 55, of Lakewood, Illinois, passed away November 25th at his home. Memorial services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, December 2nd, 2015, at the United Methodist Church in Cowden, Illinois. Visitations will be from Tuesday, December 1st, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelby, Illinois. Online condolences may be made at www.lockhartgreenfuneralhome.com. Jean Winnie Wageman, 96, passed away suddenly at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, November 25th, at the Shelby Manor. Her grandson, Greg Clagg, was at her side. A celebration of her life will be held Wednesday, December 2nd, at 6 p.m. and at the 4th Street Methodist Church in Shelbyville. Family friend Pastor Ed Hepp officiating, and after a short service, chili will be served. Everyone is welcome, and the family requests no flowers. Memorials may be made to the 4th Street Methodist Church. Kitchen Fun. Lockhart Green Funeral Homes and Shelby is in charge of the arrangements, and online condolences may be made directly to the lockhartgreenfuneralhome.com. James R. Jim Wiles, 73, of Macon, Illinois passed away peacefully at his home with his wife and daughter by his side at 2:10 a.m. on Friday, November 27, 2015. A service to celebrate Jim's life will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Homes in Macon. The family will receive friends for a time of visitations from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, with Masonic rites service at 4:45 p.m., Jim will be laid to rest in the South Macon Township Cemetery with military rites provided by the Macon County Honor Guard. Memorial contributions may be made to Cancer Care Specialists of Central Illinois or Macon County Humane Society. Melvin Mel E. Ahrens, 81, of Decatur, passed away Wednesday, November 25th, 2015, at St. Mary's Hospital and with his family by his side. Visitations will be from 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Monday, November 30th, at Graceland Fairland Funeral Homes. Services to celebrate Mel's life will be 11:30 a.m. Monday, November 30th, at the funeral home. Burial will be at Macon County Memorial Park and conclude with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard. Memorials are directed to Alzheimer's Care of Decatur, family requests casual dress. Margaret Claire, 76, of Niantic, passed away Monday, November 23rd, 2015, at the Mary St. Clinic, the Mayo, Mary St. Mary's Mayo Clinic Hospital, Rochester, Minnesota, of renal cancer. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, November 29th. Harold M. Mindgrup, 85, of Assumption, Illinois, died November 26th in Panna Community Hospital. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 30th, 2015, in Assumption Christian Church. Visitations will be from 9 to 11 a.m. prior to the service time, also in the church. Burial will be in Pleasant View Cemetery, Assumption. Memorials may be made to Assumption Christian Church. Carl W. Piper, 90, of Hammond, Illinois, passed away at 7:04 a.m. Thursday, November 26. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, November 30th, 2015, at the Hilly Gross Schrader Funeral Home, 66 East U.S. Highway, 36, Atwood, Illinois, with Reverend Mike Drake officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, November 29th, 2015, at the funeral home. Burial will be at the Grace Cemetery, Stratchburg, Illinois. Now moving on to the article headlined Government Cost Savings Groups Prepare. In Chicago, on the campaign trail and in his first weeks in office, Governor Bruce Rauner pledged to save taxpayers' money by eliminating some of Illinois' nearly 7,000 units of government, and a piece of his legislative agenda with rare bipartisan support. Now a task force for the governor named to put that idea into motion is preparing to present its recommendations. Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Saganetti, the commissioner's chairwoman, said its proposal could make government more efficient and effective if the legislator and Rauner chose to implement them. At the end of the day, the savings are going to be huge, she said. But some task force members say the year-long process is being tainted by a push to include the anti-union provisions that are among Rauner's top priorities, and that politics could prevent progress on yet another issue before Illinois lawmakers. The issue. From townships to park districts to counties, Illinois has more units of government than any other state. The state with the next highest number, Texas, has about 1,800 fewer units. Rahner said Illinois' unnecessary layers of government lead to waste, high taxes, and the opportunity for corruption. In February, he created the new task force, which roughly 24 members included legislators and the local government officials, and told them to find ways to consolidate. Rahner also asked groups to recommend which unfunded mandates the state has imposed on local governments should be repealed to reduce costs. Since then, the group has held nearly a dozen meetings inviting local leaders to speak about changes they think could streamline government. The task force has voted on dozens of proposals that will likely be part of their final report, which is due December 31st. Unfunded mandates. GOP State Representative Mark Batnick, a member of the task force, said some proposals they're considering may seem small, but the small things add up to big things, like a state mandate regarding oil changes for government-owned vehicles, state rules require the oil to be changed every 3,000 to 5,000 miles, Batnick said. That's true, even if the vehicle or the oil being used has a recommended range of 7,500 miles, meaning that over several years, the government could be spending thousands of dollars on oil changes that aren't needed. Batnick would like to see that rule eliminated. The task force is also recommending ending a requirement that governments pay out to public notices on local newspapers if those same notices are available online. Consolidation. To reduce layers of government, the group wants to impose a 4-year moratorium on new governments and give Illinois voters the ability to dissolve or consolidate governments through a referendum. Passing such a ballot measure would require a 3/5 vote, the same as amending the Illinois Constitution. It also wants to expand a 2013 law that allowed DuPage County to consolidate units within its borders, giving the same authority to all 102 counties. Since the law passed, DuPage County has dissolved a fire protection and a sanitary district. Representative Linda Holmes, an Aurora Democrat, said the key is getting local areas to decide rather than use a blanket approach. What might work in Aurora may not be the same thing that works in Decatur, she said, but Democratic Representative Jack Franks of Marengo noted expanding the DuPage pilot will politically be difficult. He sponsored the legislation to do so that passed the House, but it is stalled in the Senate. Union opposition. Franks and Holmes also said they have concerns about the proposal being approved by the task force that would weaken labor unions. One would give local governments the right to decide what part of collective bargaining with public worker unions. Another would repeal or make a change to union-backed laws requiring the government to pay a certain level of wages and benefits to workers on publicly funded projects. Holmes said she doesn't understand why the proposals are part of the group's discussion. Other than that, the attacks on collective bargaining and organized labor are the ongoing theme for Rahner. Sanghetti countered that many of the officials who spoke to the task force from cities, universities, and elsewhere said repealing those requirements would save money. When Bruce and I were chosen to lead, we promised the people we would change Illinois, she said. Franks argued that debating those measures is futile, since they have already been repeatedly shot down by the Democrats who run the legislature. And even some GOP lawmakers don't support them. Besides being a waste of time, it's a question of credibility at that point, Frank said. Tenants evicted when public housing flipped by Ben Nicholas. In Washington, in the rapidly gentrifying nation's capital, real estate investors aren't the only ones flipping houses for profit. The city's public housing authority is getting in on the action, moving aging tenants out of homes where they lived for decades, renovating them, and selling them to wealthy buyers. The renovations, at a cost of more than $300,000 per home, are outfitting the houses with luxury amenities, and some of the houses have sold for nearly $900,000. Others, however, have sat vacant for a year or longer after tenants were forced out. The Housing Authority plans to use the profits of to renovate existing subsidized rental units and build new ones. But most of that work hasn't started, and none of the money has gone to new construction yet, according to the agency. Meanwhile, sales have been slow moving and haphazard. Some elderly tenants and their children have asked for an opportunity to purchase the homes, only to be rebuffed, even after spending thousands of dollars maintaining the rental properties. The homes are known in public housing circles as scattered sites, single-family properties around Washington that are rented to public housing tenants. Many of the desirable neighborhoods, including Capitol Hill, said Shaw, were median home prices that have more than doubled in the past 15 years, due years to $500,000 plus. The District of Columbia Housing Authority once had more than 300 scattered sites and had been slowly selling them off since the 1990s. But in 2010, when the city's real estate market began to rebound after the Great Recession, the agency started treating properties as real estate investors would, gutting, rehabbing, and selling them for as much as the market could bear. Previously, homes were sold to low and moderate income buyers or to non-for-profits that maintain them as affordable housing, a practice common to housing authorities nationwide. One home on a well-kept block in Capitol Hill has been vacant since late 2013, when the longtime tenants Lula Brooks, 81, and her husband, Sonny, 82, were abruptly moved out. Brooks and her son said the housing authority threw away many of her belongings, including a washing machine, furniture, clothing, and personal documents. The authority disputes this account, but Brooks' next-door neighbor, John Wadsworth, said he watched as employees threw away the belongings. The house wasn't renovated. A year later, it was put on the market for $400,000, unusually low for the neighborhood. Eventually, it sold for that price after higher offers fell through. But the housing authority asked its title company not to sign over the deed. The sale is tied up in litigation. The rest of the houses the authority had sold in recent years has gone for market value. Others sit empty because the authority can't afford to renovate them. A year ago, Levent Graham, 84, was moved out of a five-bedroom home in Shaw, where she'd lived since the early 70s, and raised seven children. The housing authority plans to flip the house, but so far it hasn't been renovated or listed for sale. I thought the house was already sold. I thought it was on the market, so I don't know what big rush it was to get me out of the house, Graham said. Graham petitioned housing officials to buy the property with her children's help, insisting she was to move into a one-bedroom apartment in a new building for low-income seniors. The building is in a gentrifying part of Shaw, not far from her old house, but she said she doesn't feel safe because of the shooting nearby and rarely goes outside. The money that I paid there for 42 years while I was there, I could have paid for the house, Graham said. I thought I had a good chance of getting the house, but I guess I didn't. The District of Columbia law gives tenants of rent-controlled or market-rate buildings the first crack at buying them if they're placed on the market. But the law does not apply to the housing authority or its tenants because the agency is independent, leaving residents with no legal recourse to argue against being moved. The housing authority is an independent agency that gets most of its funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The authority took over management of the scattered sites originally intended as an alternative to conventional public housing from city government in the mid-90s when the city's financial struggles prompted by a takeover of Congress. Since then, it has been selling them off gradually with the HUD approval. Sunya Zatterman, executive director of the Council of Large Public Housing Authority, said houses authority nationwide have been chronically underfunded by the federal government and use creative financing strategies to maintain their properties, including selling their scattered sites and using private sector's investments to fund renovations and new construction. But she said she wasn't aware of another agency that's flipping homes the way the district is. The agency applied to HUD in March 2013. To sell Graham's and Brooks' houses and 24 other properties. The agency officials said they can't afford to maintain the single-family homes when larger complexes need upkeep and renovation. Selling the home is a responsible way for the agency to manage its asset, Housing Authority spokesman Richard White said. Because the authority hasn't been maintaining the homes, some tenants have picked up the slack. Brooks and her son said they have painted their homes, replaced faucets, installed vinyl flooring, and fixed the roof. They said they weren't reimbursed for the thousands of dollars in work because they didn't save receipts. Housing Authority spokesman White said he could not respond to the anecdotes about tenants doing their own maintenance. The agency told HUD that selling the 26 homes would generate $8.3 million, with $1 million financing constructions of new units. The authority has a funding arrangement with the HUD in which it doesn't have to stick with its budget proposals line by line. It's free to spend the money where it finds the greatest need. So far, the Housing Authority has spent $1 million in renovating one complex and $500,000 on preparation work for redevelopment of another site. Of the 26 homes, 14 have been sold. 9 others have never been listed for sale, and 3 that were listed briefly before being taken off the market. 2 row houses in Capitol Hill, half a block from the bustling 8th Street Northeast Corridor, sold for nearly $900,000 apiece. They were duplexes when controlled by the Housing Authority, but renovations transformed them into a spacious single-family residence. One of the homes has a basement apartment. The married couple who bought the home is renting that to a friend. The rear of the other home is surrounded by an 8-foot privacy fence with a porch in the driveway. Hometown celebrates Sinatra's 100th birthday. In Trenton, New Jersey, Chicago was his kind of town. L.A. was his lady, and certainly was a big part of New York, New York. But despite of a love-hate relationship, the Mile Square, New Jersey city, where Frank Sinatra was born, is finding the centennial of his birth to be a very good year. Throughout 2015, Hoboken has remembered its native son, who died in 1998 at the age of 82, with outdoor screening of his movies, a Sinatra Idol competition, and concerts that will be capped by a centennial birthday bash on December 12th at the Stevens Institute of Technology, which awarded the high school dropout an honorary degree in 1985. The small-scale event is not generating the same buzz as Sinatra's 100 and All-Star Grammy concert on December 2nd in Las Vegas, featuring Tony Bennett, Lady Gaga, Celine Dion, and other performers. Even so, the Hoboken Historical Museum has seen a 300% jump in visitors since opening a Sinatra exhibit in early August and has hired extra staff, director Robert Foster said. Whenever we do something on Sinatra, the museum tells us people come out to the woodwork, Foster said. We enjoy the fans because they're so loyal and he means so much to them. Lacking any major item that belonged to Sinatra, the museum tells a story through media displays and visitors receive a map with their $4 admission that features Sinatra sites. Greta Wilson, who was born and raised in Hoboken, said Sinatra is always the first thing that people ask her about when they learn where she's from. They always want to know if I've seen him in a store or a movie theater or in some place in town, and if he was like a regular person, or if he acted like a stuck-up movie star, she said. A plaque marks the former building at 415 Monroe Street, where Sinatra was born in 1915 to middle-class parents. "He had a nice life," said Chuck Granata, who co-produces and engineers the Nancy for Frank satellite radio program with Sinatra's oldest daughter, Nancy. Frank was not poor and probably was one of the more fortunate kids growing up. His mother made sure her son had nice clothes and even had a car, which helped him gain a spot in 1935 when singing group Hoboken 4. They won first prize on the national radio program for amateur entertainers, and Sinatra started along a path that led to big bands, Bobby Soxers, and fame. However, Hoboken residents felt Sinatra had forgotten them, reflected in the reception he got when he rode on a float in 1947 parade and was pelted with tomatoes, according to the biographer Ed Chirac. Sinatra later called Hoboken a sewer. Urban blight plagued the city until 1970, when the New Yorkers started crossing the Hudson River to renovate brownstone and build condominiums. The icy relationship between the began to thaw in 1979 when the city changed River Road to Sinatra Drive. A park and a city's main post office would also bear his name. Hoboken these days reflects Sinatra's cool, where fashionable young hipsters roam the city's bars and restaurants after spending the working day in Manhattan. This has been Samantha Barnes with the Daily Herald and Review, and for November 30th, 2015, and I look forward to reading with you again soon.